A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 26, 1986, entitled, You Are Something Wonderful. The text for the sermon is Luke 19, verses 9 and 10. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
You are something wonderful. That is the message of the morning. And I say it to you, and I apply it universally to this congregation. You are something wonderful. No exceptions allowed. It's not the case that it's true of everyone else, but you. I mean it for you. One by one, individually, and everyone that's here, you are something wonderful. You say to me, yes, that's nice, but you don't really know what you're saying, at least not in regard to me. If I were really to tell you who I am, you would not be able to say what you've just said. It would be really interesting this morning if we could hear everybody's story, if we could hear all the reasons why you refuse to receive the affirmation of the message. And I have no doubt that you have good data. I have no doubt that you could tell me about the month past or the week past. Some of you could tell me about this morning. Look what you did to your wife this morning. Or your husband, or your children. And so some of you right now are eating your hearts out because you've disappointed yourself again. And so you come and you open the bulletin, and after the first lesson, you see that the message is, you are something wonderful, and you really can't take it in. And you maybe think that it may be true of some people, but you're quite sure it's not true of you. It is just too bright, the news is too good, it is not in touch with reality. After all, who knows yourself better than you do? And there are many of you this morning that are not quite ready to receive this word. You are something wonderful. Now I want to bring that message to you because I have been focusing on that in a research project of late, and it also gives me an opportunity to tell you about some of my extracurricular activities here. The Reformed Church has just launched a new theological journal called Perspectives, a journal of Reformed thought. And I've been invited to be an editor on a board of editors of that journal. And Gorge brother Jim is the editor-in-chief. And John Stapert, who edits the Church Herald, is the managing editor. And then there are a few of us who compose the board of editors. And one of the responsibilities that we have is to set the agenda, of course, to determine the themes of each issue, and also then to submit at least two essays a year for this new venture. And just about a year ago, or I guess about a year ago, we sat down to set out the first few months. And when we came to the third issue, March of this year, which will be the season of Lent, my colleagues on that board did a number on me. They sort of got together and ganged up on me and said, would you write an essay on self-esteem theology and the cross? Now, you see, they didn't really think that one could talk about self-esteem theology and the cross in the same breath. And they didn't really think it would be possible to write an article that would have as its theme self-esteem in the season of Lent. And so I knew what they were doing to me. It was all sort of in good humor. I knew what they were doing to me, but I accepted anyway because I thought to myself, if I can't preach that during Lent, if I can't bring together the cross, crucifixion, death, and self-esteem theology, which is advocated by Robert Schuller, then that theology cannot be preached or ought not to be preached anyway. And so I accepted the assignment. I've now completed the assignment, and I set this particular message in order to share with you some of that research, because once again I've been focused on that, which I believe is a very important theme and one that is not strange to us here, but one that needs to be reiterated from time to time. To say to you, you are really something wonderful, is very important to be said to you. It is important for you to hear that and to know that it is said seriously and that it is not simply a psychological pep pill that has no rootage in reality, but that it is said seriously in the full light of the truth. You are really something wonderful. And you need to know that and to feel that, because finally that is so terribly important for you to have a sense of, to live with, to live with a kind of inward assurance that that is true, that you are something wonderful. Self-esteem, a sense of self-worth, a love for oneself, is terribly important. Without it, we'll not live positive and creative lives. Without it, we'll not really be able to love our neighbor, those around us. Without a sense of well-being, a sense of self-esteem, of self-worth, of value, of personal value, we'll not really be of value to anybody. And I don't have to reiterate here what we've gone over many times, but the church, paradoxically, ironically, the church has not really been the place, contrary to what should be the case, the church has not really been the place where you would have been overpowered with the fact that you're something wonderful. The church has often held you conditionally by a string and has always been alert to the moment at which you might get the impression that you were just a little bit wonderful, ready to knock you down, lest pride rear its ugly head. And so we've not really done a very good job of affirming people and grounding them in the truth that they are something wonderful because they are created in the image of God. They have been created with a divine intentionality for the full realization of their humanity, for the full development of a potential within them in order that they might reflect the divine image. We, human beings, are really something wonderful. And we need to hear that, and that's the message of this morning. Now, I suppose the critical question is, well, if you're going to say I'm something wonderful, then you have to deny the whole record of the life I've written. You have to deny my story. Let me tell you my story. Okay, tell me your story. I suppose it's a horror story, huh? You want to tell me about all the darkness? You want to tell me about all the disappointments, all the failures? You want to tell me about everything you've done wrong? I know there are a lot of words I could use to describe folks like you, but I don't dare use them because I'm in church. They apply words that don't really fit in a sermon. Nancy will relax to know I'm not going to use them. She gets nervous at times like that. I know that. They apply to me too. There's hardly anything that we can't apply to ourselves that doesn't fit at one time or another. And if we're going to pile it all up, if we're going to scrape it all together, well, we're going to have quite a mountain. Because we've done quite a job. I mean, how far do you want to go back? Our story is filled with shadow. There is a shadow side to all of us. And then, of course, only part of that shadow side has ever seen the light of day. Only part of that shadow side of us has actually been lived out and become concrete action. But you ought to know what's been in my head. Huh? You too, huh? Aren't you glad that no one around these days has X-ray vision? They said of Jesus that he could look right through you. You were transparent. He knew what was in the heart. Well, glad he's not walking the dusty streets of Spring Lake, huh? Because it's not only our actual action, but it's the shadow side that crops up. And when we look at it, Hans Kung is right, and we cite him on the back of our bulletin with good reason. It's not that the bad guys are out there. It's that all of us are alike. And the line between good and evil runs right through the community, right through the church, right through my heart. If I'm not a brother to every man and woman, if I am not a participant in everything that is human, black and white, light and dark, then I really don't know the first thing about myself. So I say, well, you're really something wonderful. And now I come back to say, but look at the record. Look at the havoc. Look at the hell on earth. Look at the meanness, the stinginess, the narrowness of spirit. Look at how we hurt one another. Look at all of the negative, demonic behavior that is obvious on every side. How can one say, you're something wonderful? Well, by making a very important distinction. And in his book, Self-Esteem Theology, A New Reformation, Bob Schuller makes this distinction, and I think a very significant distinction, a distinction between our nature as a human person created in the image of God and our reactive behavior as people who are afraid, who live without basic fundamental trust. He uses the illustration of a golf ball, which is an excellent illustration, I think, an analogy of the human person. The dimpled surface of a golf ball gives you little indication of what's inside. But if you did as I did when you were a kid, you ripped and peeled that cover off until you saw all of the millions of miles of rubber bands stretched with great tension around a very little hard core. That little hard core, when you got down to it, could bounce over the roof. There was a lot of reaction in that little core. Now, Schuller says that little core characterized in the natural person by a lack of trust or fear. And because that core of the person is characterized by fear or lack of trust, the behavior as a consequence of that core becomes negative behavior. So that all of those rubber bands stretched around that core are illustrative of all of the negative reactive behavior that is the consequence of the fear that is at the very center of our being, naturally. However, fear at the core of our being is already a step removed from the core of our being as we came from the hand of our Creator. The core of that being is distorted. The core of that being is unlocked, unplugged, disconnected from its native soil in the eternal God. For basically, fundamentally, human nature created for God, to rest in God, to be rooted in God, is to be characterized by trust, which issues in love. But where we get disconnected and unplugged, that core of trust turns to lack of trust, to fear. And fear becomes the generating center of all kinds of hellish behavior. And we go around like demons, creating hell on earth. If I had to deny the reality of the human situation in order to say to you, you are something wonderful, then I would not say you are something wonderful, because I don't want to live without self-awareness, do you? I don't want anybody to play psychological tricks on me. The truth may be painful, but I want to know the truth. The truth may hurt, but I want to know the truth. We can delude ourselves for a while. We can bluff our way through for a time. We can put up a good front. But down deep, I think we really want to know the truth. And we know the truth. And the truth is that we can stir up so much trouble. Our reactive behavior is not reflective of the person God made us to be, but of a person out of touch, disconnected, unplugged, uprooted from that soil of the eternal God and His eternal love. And so there's a distinction between what we are and what we have become through our fearful, reactive behavior. But we need to be reminded who we are. And when I say you're really something wonderful, I mean it. Because no matter how many rubber bands have been stretched around that core at the pit of your soul, there is still there that humanity that has been created by the eternal God, and that has always the potential at any moment of responding to grace and being renewed once again in the image of Jesus Christ. And when I say to you, you are really something wonderful, it is in order to say to you something that is true, and maybe something that will shock you with a contrast between what you really are and potentially can be again, and what you have become in the sloshing through of this mundane life. Zacchaeus was that way. He was just a little man. He was very rich. He was an angry little man, I think. Probably angry that he was little. Probably had experienced the hateful behavior of other kids when he was a kid. Probably had taken all of the body blows he could handle, having been isolated and set apart, and probably in some dark moment in his past had said, "I'll show you to the whole world joined himself up to be a collaborator with a hated enemy, took a position as a tax collector which could exploit the poor and the oppressed and the weak, gained himself a tremendous fortune, had tremendous power, real clout, was exceedingly sharp, totally unscrupulous, full of anger, and very miserable. I suppose he heard about Matthew. Matthew was a tax collector too up in Galilee. If you read the 5th chapter of Luke's gospel, you read the story of how Jesus came to the tax office and said to Matthew, or Levi as he's called, "Follow me." And Matthew got up with the till still open and followed Jesus. And threw a party. What a party it must have been. All of the tax collectors. Boy, did they have stories to swap. Better than an AA meeting, I suppose. The word dribbled down, I think, to Jericho. The old tax collector's grapevine was active with the fact, did you hear what happened to Matthew? So that when the word spread that Jesus was coming that way, Zacchaeus, because in spite of his unscrupulous behavior, in spite of all of his anger, his resentment, his hostility, still and all, buried down in the depths of the human heart, there were chords that, when touched, could vibrate once more. He got himself out on a limb just for a look at Jesus. And of course, it was that look, that encounter that transformed him. Hospitality was the highest rule of the land. To break bread with another was the highest affirmation one could accord. The church people murmured, of course. They said, "He's gone in to be a guest of sinners, and the righteous ought not to have anything to do with sinners." But Jesus didn't see Zacchaeus, the angry, hostile tax collector. He saw Zacchaeus, the miserable, lonely man who longed for some human kindness, some touch of grace, some possibility to begin again. And he went into his home and broke his bread and brought salvation. No holding Zacchaeus at arm's length to see what his response would be. No saying to Zacchaeus, "Zacchaeus, may I hear your confession?" None of that. Just touching that humanity that was still there, that wasn't totally calloused over with the hate and the anger of his disappointed life, able to get through to the person who was really something wonderful, and let them know that the love of God was theirs through the love of Jesus. Ah, that kind of encounter with grace changes the core from fear to trust. And the issue of the core from demonic behavior to liberation and love and all that is positive. Jesus did not seem to hedge his bets. He didn't seem hesitant at all to throw his arms around a poor risk. He didn't withhold his love or withhold himself. He encountered a miserable, lonely, angry man with the affirmation of love. And the man was transformed. Because Jesus believed that Zacchaeus was something wonderful. Not just afterward, but before as well. If anyone had eyes to see. Oh, for eyes to see as Jesus sees. And oh, for the radical faith to believe that it is true of me and true of you. We are really something wonderful.